All right, now it's time to go to lipid synthesis. Lipid synthesis, of course, refers to making lipids. We've already talked about fatty acid synthesis, which is a different process. Fatty acid synthesis, of course, makes fatty acids. Well, fatty acids can themselves be components of lipids or the breakdown products of fatty acids can be used as precursors to make other lipids. So, lipids is a much more diverse class than just fatty acids. Fatty acids are themselves lipids, but here, by lipid synthesis, we're referring to making other lipids out of either fatty acids directly or something that comes from fatty acids. And there are a few major categories of lipids that we're going to look at, which we've talked about the major classes of lipids before. What are major classes of lipids? Fats or triacylglycerols, right? Or triglycerides, they're all the same thing. What else? What'd you say? Steroids, right? Phospholipids. And when I say when we say phospholipids, we're talking about membrane lipids, right? One kind of membrane lipid. But there are other lipids that are important for membranes as well that are also related to steroids, right? What am I talking about? Cholesterol. Cholesterol is important, vitally important. We can't live without cholesterol because cholesterol by itself is an important membrane component, but it also serves as the precursor for all the steroids. So we'll talk about all of those at least briefly in this chapter. Lipid synthesis, though, is pretty complex because of the fact that there are so many different kinds of lipids, and therefore there is a correspondingly huge variety of variations on the pathways involved in creating the many different kinds of lipids. So we're not going to do what we usually do in this chapter, which is to look at every tiny detail and every enzyme. In fact, we're going to skip most of the enzyme names in this chapter. I'm only going to talk about a couple. Because what I'm showing you in this chapter really are just some examples from each of the major pathways corresponding to the major kinds of lipids. But this is by far not all the detail that you could get into if you really wanted to study lipids. In this first slide, though, we've looked at a slide that's similar to this in a different chapter, but you see how a lot of different pathways can be involved with each other, in this case for lipid synthesis. The major site of lipid synthesis is the liver, which is it's yet another job that it does, yet another reason it's such an important organ. So that's represented by the yellow box over there. And phosphatidate that's shown here in this yellow box is an important intermediate. It's kind of like a fork in the road because phosphatidate, as you see by the two arrows coming from it, can be used to make either triacylglycerols, fats, or phospholipids of different sorts. Now, each of these is a class of compounds, right? There are many different kinds of triacylglycerols. There are many different kinds of phospholipids, but to make either one of those, you need phosphatidate as one of the components. Okay? Phosphatidate is just the name for the deprotonated version of phosphatidic acid, as the 8 ending implies, right? But Phosphatidate is also just another name for what could be called diacylglycerol 3-phosphate. Now notice the two arrows coming in to the left of phosphatidate. You have glycerol 3-phosphate and fatty acids coming together to form phosphatidate. All right? Glycerol 3-phosphate, of course, gives you that glycerol backbone that you find in not only a triacylglycerol, but a phospholipid as well. Right? Where do we get the glycerol 3-phosphate? Well, we can get it by converting dihydroxyacetone phosphate, DHAP, which you should already be familiar with. That is an intermediate in glycolysis. So pathway one is glycolysis. We can take some of that DHAP that glycolysis produces as an intermediate and transform it into glycerol 3-phosphate. Combine that with some fatty acyls that you either get from food, so fats that are digested are already triacylglycerols, right? But those don't come directly into the body. They're dismantled in the lumen of the intestine into free fatty acids and glycerol, which then get packaged into chylomicrons, which we'll talk about later, and that they are going to be carrying fatty acids from the food you ate. So the fatty, that's why this white box is labeled adipose tissue or diet. Yes, there are fatty acids that you can get by breaking down fats in adipose tissue, but you're also continuously bringing in fatty acids from the fat that you eat. Anyway, those can be combined with glycerol 3-phosphate to make phosphatidate. But the reason that another name for phosphatidate, and it'll make more sense when we look at a picture, another name is diacylglycerol 3-phosphate is because when you take that glycerol 3-phosphate, which is just the 3-carbon glycerol with a phosphate stuck on the 3rd carbon, and you add 2 acyls, 2 fatty acids, you have diacylglycerol 3-phosphate. Okay? That is what you need if you're going to make either a triacylglycerol in the liver or a phospholipid. All right, so triacylglycerol breakdown, that's happening in adipose tissue. If the fat is already in your body and being stored, it can, of course, be broken down. That's going to liberate glycerol. Right? That's one source of the glycerol. The other one would be from dihydroxyacetone phosphate. The free fatty acids are the other breakdown product of that breakdown of triacylglycerols. And 3 and 4 are triacylglycerol synthesis and phospholipid synthesis, which are subjects of this chapter. By the way, notice that if you're going to use the phosphatidate to make a phospholipid instead of a triacylglycerol, you're going to have to add an alcohol to the mix. So phosphatidate and alcohol need to combine to make a phospholipid, as you see on the right side here. And notice it says that to do that, you're going to need to activate one of those two components. Now, typically, when we're talking about syntheses before, when you're bringing things together to build a bigger thing, you're going to have to activate the subunit in order to have the energy to do that synthesis, right? So it's nothing new to have an activated subunit be used for a synthetic process. In this case, though, it could be either the phosphatidate that's activated or the alcohol, depending on the specific phospholipid that's going to be made. And I'll show you examples of both of those. But notice that it's being activated by a reaction with an NTP. What's an NTP? a nucleoside triphosphate. So that's just the general word, meaning some sort of nucleoside triphosphate. Yeah?
Just so it's clearly established that you can still form a phospholipid if both are activated at the same time.
No, it's not going to be both that are activated. It's going to be one or the other. But different phospholipids, you start with one or the other activated depending on what the phospholipid is. So I'm glad you asked that. Yeah, they're not both activated, one or the other. So it's an exclusive or in terms of logic. All right. Slide 2. Well, this shows you the process of formation of phosphatidate, starting with glycerol 3-phosphate. It's really just, well, notice what glycerol phosphate is, what I told you a moment ago. The glycerol itself is simply the 3-carbon triple alcohol, right? Glycerol by itself has the 3 hydroxyls, that's why it's a triple alcohol. And so those hydroxyls are connection points, right? Which is why if we're going to connect a fatty acyl to every one of those 3, what we end up making is a triacyl glycerol. Well, glycerol 3-phosphate is simply a glycerol with a phosphoryl group stuck to one of those connection points, namely the 3rd carbon. So the first thing is that coenzyme A comes into the situation carrying a fatty acyl. So R1COCOA, that is just shorthand for an acyl coenzyme A. We don't know what the acyl is. It's some hydrocarbon chain, so it's some sort of fatty acyl. We don't know the length of the chain or whether there are double bonds or not, right? Because there are different kinds of fatty acyls. But it's a coenzyme A carrying a fatty acyl. And it comes in and drops that fatty acyl, represented by R1, off to one of those other 2 connection points, namely the 1st carbon. So R1, that's some length of fatty acid chain. And that intermediate is, as you see, lysophosphatidate. Well, then the same thing happens again, except it might not be the same fatty acyl. It usually is not. What usually happens is that this first fatty acyl that's added is saturated, so there probably won't be any double bonds in the blue fatty acyl. And then the second one that's added, being carried by its own coenzyme A, is usually unsaturated. So it could be monounsaturated or polyunsaturated, but typically it's monounsaturated. But these aren't rules, because it doesn't necessarily have to be this way. This is just usually. In any case, by the time you have two coenzyme A, each carrying its own fatty acyl, stick that fatty acyl onto the remaining 2 connection points that aren't taken up by the phosphate, what you have is something you can either call phosphatidate, or, as I said, diacyl glycerol 3-phosphate. They're just different names for the same stuff. All right? And so that's the master building block for either triacyl glycerol synthesis or phospholipid synthesis. So this is occurring in the liver. Primarily. I mean, the liver is not the only tissue that can do this, but that's the primary site. All right, now to slide 3. Once we have phosphatidate, or diacyl glycerol 3-phosphate, it's a simple matter of stripping off that phosphate, or phosphoryl group, I should say, to form just diacyl glycerol rather than diacyl glycerol 3-phosphate, right? Now that 3rd carbon just has its hydroxyl again, just like it would in normal glycerol. And if you're trying to make it, well, I should have prefaced this slide by saying let's assume that we're wanting to make a triacyl glycerol out of our phosphatidate. That's what's happening here. So to make a triacyl glycerol, you have to connect all three connection points with fatty acyls, right? But you need to first get rid of that phosphoryl group. That's why you have this diacyl glycerol intermediate. Once you have diacyl glycerol, you have an empty spot open for another acyl group to be coming to come in, being carried by its own coenzyme A. So now you have R1, R2, R3. Those just represent three fatty acyls. They could be the same thing. They could all be different. There could be two the same and one different. There's all kinds of combinations because there are all kinds of different fatty acyls. But it doesn't matter. Whatever fatty acyl you have, whether it's saturated, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated, regardless of chain length, all fatty acyls still have that same end to them, right? With the carbonyl group at the end. Actually, it's a carboxyl group when it's a fatty acid by itself. But it becomes a carbonyl group when you form the, when you undergo the condensation reaction that hooks it to the glycerol. And do you remember what kind of bonds those are called? That hook a fatty acyl to the glycerol in a triacyl glycerol? Ester bonds, right. Ester linkages or ester bonds. Exactly. So there are three such ester linkages in a triacyl glycerol. That is otherwise known as a fat or a triglyceride. And that, of course, is the storage form of fatty acids. When you're just trying to store these fatty acids for later use as energy, or as fuel, I mean, to produce energy, you store them much more compactly as triacyl glycerol than you would with just as free fatty acids. And the reason it's such a good storage of energy is for a couple main reasons. One is that fatty acids by themselves, being hydrocarbons, have a lot of, they are highly reduced and therefore can be oxidized repeatedly, making a lot of NADH, right? Which then goes on to make a lot of ATP. But a triacyl glycerol is also a structure that almost completely excludes water, and which is why fats are so hydrophobic. And that makes them be able to be stored very compactly. So you have a bunch of energy in terms of being highly reduced, but you also store it in a very compact manner. And therefore, adipose tissue is chock full of energy. But it's also really important. Fat is not only important for storage of energy, fat's also very important because it has a lot of thermal resistance. So it's a very good insulator. Keeps us either cool or warm depending on what the temperature of the outside is compared to us, the inside the body. And it's also really important as packing material. It's a very good cushioning substance that will protect organs from damage. All right. That's triacyl glycerol synthesis. If we go to slide 4 now, we can talk about phospholipid synthesis. And there are two major classes of phospholipids. Anyone remember them? What'd you say? Sphingolipids is one of them, which uses a sphingosine base. What is the base of the other type of phospholipids? Glycerol, which is why they're also called phosphoglycerides. So phosphoglycerides and sphingolipids are two types of phospholipids. All phospholipids, though, have what important property that allows them to function as membrane lipids? In fact, allows for biological membranes to exist, and therefore the first cell to exist, and therefore us to exist. What do we call that in one word? Right, they are amphipathic molecules, which means within the same molecule there is both a polar region and a nonpolar region. Well, the polar region is usually called the head, right? That has a charge associated with it, so it's really beyond polar. And the nonpolar region are the fatty acyls. And why are they nonpolar? Well, that's just another way of saying that they're nonpolar. But why, chemically, why are they nonpolar? Right, because of what? What are they made of? They're hydrocarbons, right? Except for that very tip of the where they're connected to the rest of the phospholipid molecule, it's nothing but carbons and hydrogens, and those have almost equal electronegativities, therefore there isn't unequal sharing, there's equal sharing, which by definition is nonpolar. Okay? Well, in a previous slide, that first slide, I think it was, I said that if you're going to make a phospholipid starting with phosphatidate, you need to add that phosphatidate to an alcohol of some sort, which will become part of the head, the polar head. And there are different choices of alcohol corresponding to different kinds of phospholipids. Of course, phospholipids also can vary just because there are different kinds of fatty acyls making up the tails. But anyway, when you add a phosphatidate to an alcohol, you need to have one of those two things activated, right? In order for the synthesis to occur, the coming together of the two subunits. So we said that either one of these two things can be activated, but just one of them will be activated, depending on the product being made finally. In slide 4, we see an example of an activated phosphatidate, rather than an activated alcohol. Okay? What we have here is called CDP phosphatidate. Now, or CDP diacyl glycerol. Notice, though, that the braces don't show CDP, but CMP. Well, first of all, what does this stand for? What is CMP? Or CDP? Or CTP? It is, what? Which one? What did you say the C stands for? Choline is going to be important for a different reason, but that's not what this is. Well, what is ATP? Adenosine triphosphate, right? Named for the fact that the nucleoside part of that is adenosine. Adenosine gets its name because the nitrogenous base part of that nucleoside is adenine, right? So adenine and ribose make up the nucleoside called adenosine. We've also talked about GDP and GTP, right? That's guanosine triphosphate. Guanosine is the nucleoside that has as its nitrogenous base guanine. Well, the C here indicates that the nitrogenous base is which one of the five that you're familiar with? Cytosine. When you have a cytosine and a ribose, you make still another version of a nucleoside, which is called cytidine, with a D instead of an S. And therefore, you have cytidine triphosphate, cytidine diphosphate, and cytidine monophosphate as possibilities, just like ATP, ADP, and AMP. Okay. Well, the reason that it's labeled as CMP here is because a cytidine triphosphate on its own, with three phosphates, of course, is going to come and pick up a diacylglycerol 3-phosphate. In other words, a phosphatidate. In doing that, it's going to cleave off two of its 3-phosphates. It's going to lose a pyrophosphate, in other words. Right? Leaving just CMP, but that CMP is now connected to diacylglycerol 3-phosphate, or phosphatidate. All right? That's the way, that's why it's shown, the braces are shown that way. But it's called CDP, diacylglycerol, because we're including both of those phosphates with the cytidine in the name. And then, even though one of those came from phosphatidate already, was there, that's just the reason we're calling it CDP, diacylglycerol. But functionally speaking, what happens, as you see in slide 5, is that is what I said. CTP, with three of its own phosphate, comes along and loses two of them as pyrophosphate, PP sub I. This allows connection with phosphatidate, which is already carrying its own pink phosphate. And it does that by connecting the phosphate of phosphatidate to the only phosphate or phosphoryl group that's remaining in CMP, right? Forming a phosphoester bond between two phosphates, in other words. So now, even though one of these phosphoryls was already there, we give credit. The blue and the pink part together make up CDP, and the black part is diacylglycerol. Okay? So that's why the whole thing is called CDP diacylglycerol. That is the activated form of phosphatidate. And so if you do it this way, which happens in for certain phospholipids, then you don't have to have an activated alcohol. The alcohol can just be ordinary alcohol, unactivated. But you need one of them to be activated to provide the energy for bringing the two together, which is an anabolic process or synthetic process. Okay? So, first of all, there's different kinds of CDP diacylglycerol already because we don't know what these acyls hanging off of this glycerol are. Right? So there's different versions just because of that. But then CDP diacylglycerol can drop its most of this cargo, everything except the blue part, off to any of several different alcohols, creating any of several different phospholipids. In a lot of cases, the alcohol is inositol, which is spelled thus. And if inositol is used as the alcohol, then you end up making what is called phosphatidyl inositol, which you might remember as being a pretty common membrane phospholipid. Okay, and that's the way that goes by the pathway in which the precursor that is activated is the phosphatidate rather than the alcohol. Phosphatidyl inositol, even though it's a pretty common phospholipid, is not the most abundant mammalian phospholipid. Anyone remember what is? Phosphatidylcholine, yes. Good. Well, that's made in a different way, but so is another common one, which is phosphatidylethanolamine. All right? Either one of those, phosphatidylcholine or phosphatidylethanolamine, are made by activating the alcohol rather than the phosphatidate. And so in slide 6, we see this using ethanolamine as an example. Ethanolamine is the alcohol that you start with. And why is this stuff called ethanolamine Well, what does the eth part of that mean? Two carbons, right. One carbon is meth, two carbons is eth. So if all you had were two carbons and then filled with nothing but hydrogen, you would have what? Ethane, right. If you substitute one of those hydrogens with a hydroxyl instead, you have an alcohol instead of an alkane, and therefore we call that ethaneol or ethanol, which is the alcohol that we drink in beverages, or at least I do. If you substitute another one of those hydrogens with an amino group, NH3, then you have ethanol amine or ethanolamine. But it is an alcohol. All right? And the first step, you see, is just to phosphorylate this thing using a phosphoryl from ATP. Now you have phosphoryl ethanolamine. Then CTP comes along, cytidine triphosphate. And just like its use in the other case, it loses a pyrophosphate so that it can pick up this phosphoryl ethanolamine and activate it. Now we have CDP ethanolamine. All right? And then finally, diacyl glycerol comes along. Well, diacyl glycerol is is carrying two fatty acyls, right? And the glycerol molecule. And it displaces the cytidine monophosphate, the blue part of this. So now you have phosphatidylethanolamine. Okay? So you activate the alcohol in this case first, then you bring in a run-of-the-mill diacyl glycerol, and you have a phospholipid called phosphatidylethanolamine, but it can happen for other alcohols as well that are activated first, including choline. So we just said a little bit ago that the most abundant mammalian, and therefore in you, membrane phospholipid is phosphatidylcholine. Well, the same thing basically happens using choline instead of ethanolamine. And choline is the same stuff that's in acetylcholine, right? So it's used for different stuff. And it's primarily a dietary substance. So you get choline in your diet, some of which you use by activating it in order to make a phosphatidylcholine. But phosphatidylcholine is such an important membrane lipid that if you are running low on dietary choline, you have the ability to make phosphatidylcholine out of other stuff. That's what's shown on slide 7. So if you go through all the same steps of slide 6 and make phosphatidylethanolamine, that then can be modified into phosphatidylcholine, as you see here. And really what you're doing is just triply methylating this thing, which is why you need 3 adenosyl methionines, each of which contributes a methyl group that gets stuck onto this nitrogen, replacing the hydrogens. That's really the big difference between phosphatidylethanolamine and phosphatidylcholine, is that the phosphatidylcholine is methylated. All right, those are phosphoglycerides that we just produced, which are just one major class of phospholipids. Remember, we said that the others are sphingolipids. And we can see in slide 8 the process of producing sphingolipids. It starts with palmitoyl coenzyme A. Now, palmitoyl refers to the specific acyl that you get from palmitate. Palmitate is the name of the free fatty acid. It's a complete molecule, right? And remember, we said that that's kind of the master fatty acid. 16 carbons, fully saturated. And notice the abbreviation here. There's 12 of them right here, so they just don't show you the long, boring chain. But there are 16 carbons in palmitic acid, which in the deprotonated form is called palmitate. And then when you stick that onto a coenzyme A, you have palmitoyl coenzyme A. All right? Well, what happens here is that you take a serine. What is serine? It's an amino acid, so you should recognize the basic amino acid structure. It has everything an amino acid should have. You stick that onto palmitoyl that coenzyme A is carrying. Coenzyme A drops it off to serine, basically, because you have coenzyme A coming out of the situation. And you also decarboxylate it in order to make the intermediate 3-ketosphingonine. Sphingonine with an N. All right? That then gets reduced with the help of NADPH. Now it's NADPH, not NADH. Why does that make sense? Well, they both have reducing power because they're both carrying hydrogens that they can stick onto something else. But why does it make sense in this case to use NADPH rather than NADH? It's biosynthesis, exactly. We're building something up rather than tearing it down for the purpose of energy. NADH is used in catabolic processes for the purpose of creating ATP. NADPH is used for reductive biosynthesis. So that will get you, by sticking those hydrogens on, you eliminate the double bond there with the oxygen, and that makes dihydrosphingosine, which is why these things are called sphingolipids. And then you pick some hydrogens off in the next step. That's why you end up reducing FAD into FADH2. But that is eventually going to make ceramide. Well, I skipped a step. You go to dihydroceramide and then to ceramide. Ceramide is kind of the master sphingolipid, and it's important as a sphingolipid by itself, but it also then can go on be modified to produce other kinds of sphingolipids. Ceramide, by the way, is an important component of cerumen. C-E-R-U-M-E-N. What is that stuff? Earwax is cerumen, right. And in slide 9, you can see that ceramide then can go on and be transformed into other kinds of sphingolipids. Phosphatidylcholine can be incorporated with ceramide, leaving just the pink part. Diacylglycerol is what's left. That's coming off of the situation. But the pink part gets hooked onto ceramide to make sphingomyelin, which is another important class of sphingolipids that, as the name indicates, you find not only, but you find especially high concentrations of this particular sphingolipid in myelin sheath, which is a lipid coating around certain axons of the nervous system, greatly increasing the speed of action potential propagation. Same is true for cerebroside, but it's a different composition. Instead, you take ceramide and you add glucose to the top of it that comes in via UDP glucose, carrying that glucose, the activated form of glucose, right? Still another nucleoside phosphate, right? Using uracil instead of cytosine, guanine, or adenine. But anyway, once that glucose gets dropped off, now you have cerebroside with a glucose here. And that's useful stuff in its own right. Like I said, that's also in myelin sheaths. But you can then add even other sugars to this glucose. So this is part of the variety still, to make various kinds of gangliosides, which are also really important in the nervous system. which is where you find ganglia. All right, let's go to 10. In this kind of flow chart, we see that going back and forth between phosphatidate and diacylglycerol is a way for the cell to control which kinds of lipids it makes. If phosphatidate gets turned into diacylglycerol, going left to right, then that diacylglycerol can be used to form any of several different phospholipids, phosphatidylethanolamine, phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylserine, or even triacylglycerols, fats, rather than phospholipids. And so if that's what's needed, then that's the direction this central reaction is going to proceed. And the way this is controlled is by phosphorylation or dephosphorylation. So if phosphatidate gets dephosphorylated, then you make diacylglycerol. And the enzyme responsible for that is phosphatidic acid phosphatase, right? On the other hand, if you need the stuff on the left-hand side, phosphatidylinositol or cardiolipin, other kinds of phospholipids, then the reverse is going to happen. Diacylglycerol is going to be phosphorylated to make phosphatidate. And the source of the phosphate is ATP, but the enzyme responsible for doing that, as you would expect, is a kinase, diacylglycerol kinase. So diacylglycerol kinase and phosphatidic acid phosphatase are exact opposites in function, allowing this reversible reaction to go in the appropriate direction depending on what the cell needs. Notice that adding to this complexity is that both diacylglycerol and phosphatidate themselves are not just precursors, they also act in their own right as important second messengers. Like you might have learned or should have learned about DAG and PIP3. Do you remember these in signal transduction pathways? Yeah. Exactly. All right, but that's the subject of a different chapter. Let's go to slide 11 now and talk about cholesterol. Cholesterol synthesis has as its committed step, its most important step in terms of control of the enzyme, the conversion of 3-hydroxy-3-methylglutaryl coenzyme A into mevalonate. That's what we're looking at. And I will give you the enzyme name here because it is an important control enzyme. Is HMG coenzyme A reductase. The HMG stands for hydroxymethylglutaryl. Okay? So, you'd expect some reduction to be happening here, right, since it's a reductase. Well, that's why you need, for this to happen, 2 NADPHs and 2 protons. Okay? So, a total of 4 hydrogens get used in this process. 3 of them end up getting stuck on to the carbon whose double bond is eliminated, and which is actually on the bottom here. So these 3 hydrogens get added to where that was a CO, C double bond O. The other hydrogen takes the place of all of the stuff that's being carried by coenzyme A, just turning it back into ordinary coenzyme A, which has an SH, right, not just S. So that is a reduction. That makes mevalonate, and mevalonate is necessary for the rest of the process, of course. But that first step, that's the committed step, that reductase enzyme is the one that's has the most control exercised on it. Once you have mevalonate, though, we can see that we can transform that stepwise, slide 12, into 3-isopentanyl pyrophosphate. This involves a sequence of phosphorylations, which is why you have ATP being used several times. All right? Isopentanyl pyrophosphate, as the name implies, has, first of all, a pyrophosphate hanging off of it, two phosphates in series. But also the pent part of the name indicates that it's a five-carbon compound. All right? This 3-isopentanyl pyrophosphate, being a five-carbon compound, is then going to be used so that we can combine two C5s into a C10, then add another C5 to make a C15, do all of that twice so that we have two C15s, then combine those into a C30, a 30-carbon compound, which is then modified into the final form, cholesterol. Cholesterol actually has 27 carbons, so in the final process, three of those carbons get lost. But you build it up into a 30-carbon compound using these 5-carbon subunits to begin with. All right, let's look at the details of that. Isopentanyl pyrophosphate, which was just what spit out from the previous slide, we're looking at 13 now, can easily and reversibly be isomerized into dimethylallyl pyrophosphate. The difference is the placement of that double bond, as you see. The reason it's nice that this is fully reversible is that you actually, when I said that you have two C5s combined to form a C10, well, it's one of each of these, so you need both of them. You need an isopentanyl pyrophosphate and a dimethylallyl pyrophosphate, as we see in slide 14. At the top, dimethylallyl pyrophosphate and isopentanyl pyrophosphate combine to form a C10 compound, geranyl pyrophosphate. Now, since each of those two precursors had its own pyrophosphate, one of those gets lost, which is why you have PPI coming out. So the geranyl pyrophosphate is a 10-carbon, a C10, and in comes another C5 in the form of isopentanyl pyrophosphate. Now that's going to form a 15-carbon compound with pyrophosphate on it. Once again, a pyrophosphate leaves. That's farnesyl pyrophosphate. Okay, you do all of that twice so that you have two farnesyl pyrophosphates come together, each carrying 15 carbons. And now when they combine, you have the 30-carbon compound, squalene. All right? That's not cholesterol yet, because what do you know about cholesterol structure? It has rings in it, yes. Squalene is not a ringed structure. So I shouldn't say the final step, because there are actually many, many steps left. But the final set of steps is to cyclize this squalene to form the rings. And slide 15 shows you just some of the detail. Squalene to squalene epoxide, protosterol cation, lanosterol, and then 19 more steps that aren't even shown before you finally get to cholesterol. And you should be familiar with this ringed structure of cholesterol. Not only the fact that there are rings, but specifically there are four rings in this arrangement. Cholesterol has this, but so do cholesterol derivatives, things that cholesterol gets modified into, like the steroid hormones. So three of those rings are six-membered, and then sticking off on the right side of those three six-membered rings is a five-membered ring. All right? Cholesterol and its derivatives, including all the steroid hormones, are very similar because they all have that same ring structure. The only difference is what the functional groups are that stick off of the various corners. And that's why things that stick off of the main part of a molecule are called functional groups, because they really determine the overall function of the molecule. The rest of it is just structure. All right. But anyway, that's cholesterol. And like I said, cholesterol just by itself is important in unmodified form as a membrane component. Animals make this. Plants make a similar thing. What are plant versions called? Phytosterols. Correct. Phyto meaning plant. Why is cholesterol called cholesterol? Yeah, coal is bile. Stair, as in stereo, means solid or three-dimensional because of this ring structure. So coal sterol, or cholesterol, really means literally means bile, solid, alcohol. Notice that it has hydroxyl on it, so it is an alcohol. So cholesterol is important for membrane lipids, and in membranes, it buffers the fluidity. So depending on how much cholesterol is embedded in between the phospholipids that make up the membrane, the fluidity stays in a nice range. It's important for membrane fluidity to be just right. You don't want a membrane to be too loose or too tight. As temperature decreases, membranes tighten up because things solidify. As temperature increases, things get too loose. Well, cholesterol will, in cold temperatures, make the membrane more fluid than it would otherwise, which is appropriate because you don't want it to solidify. But it also keeps it from getting too loose when temperature is high. That's why I say it buffers the fluidity. Cholesterol, though, is also important as a component of bile. Cholesterol gets turned into bile salts. Bile salts, of course, are components of bile. What is bile for, mainly? And it has several functions, but why does the liver produce bile? That's the glandular function of the liver. The liver is much more than a gland, obviously. But it's the largest gland in the body, produces a lot of bile as its glandular secretion. That bile gets sent where first? To the gallbladder, which not only stores the bile, but takes some water out of it, so it concentrates it before it gets released into the lumen of the small intestine. So bile is a digestive secretion. The bile salts that are a component of bile and that come from cholesterol are detergents. Detergents are other examples of amphipathic molecules. A detergent like, you know, the reason soap works on your hands to clean them, unless if you have oily hands, rinsing them with water is not going to do the job, right? Because oil and water don't mix. They're one's hydrophobic, one's hydrophilic. But if you use soap, the hydrophobic parts of that amphipathic soap molecule is going to be right up against the oil, and the hydrophilic part is going to be right up against the water. That ends up breaking this film of oil into tiny little beads. It emulsifies the oil, in other words. Each bead is surrounded by hydrophilic parts of the soap molecule that have no problem interacting with the water. So when you rinse it, you basically just rinse away all these billions of little spheres of oil. And your hands feel clean. Well, it's important to do this in your gut as well, because if you have a big slug of fat coming through from something you've eaten, if you have a big droplet of oil, what you need to do in order to use that for energy, in order to get it into your body so that it can be used for energy, is to digest it, of course, just like any other nutrient. When you digest oil, you're using enzymes to do that, to break it into free fatty acids. Well, enzymes need to come into contact with that oil in order to break it down. And that's going to happen, if it's a big oil droplet, only at the surface, right? A big oil droplet has a lower surface area to volume ratio than many small oil droplets do. When you break one big oil droplet into a bunch of tiny oil droplets, you have a combined much greater surface area to volume ratio, and therefore a lot more opportunity for lipases, lipid digesting enzymes, to get onto that surface and break it down into things that are small enough to actually be absorbed by the epithelium of the small intestine so that your body can use it. So that's why you have detergent in the form of bile salts. Bile doesn't digest the oil, it just disperses it. It emulsifies it. It's an emulsifier. All right, so that's... And like we said before, cholesterol is also, of course, important for being a precursor to all the steroid hormones. In 16, we're looking at something that, as far as the names of these things are concerned, is fairly ridiculous. But notice the nucleus up here in the upper right. The nucleus, of course, has chromosomes in it. On one of those chromosomes is a gene that codes for the protein that we said is the master enzyme, the one that produces the malate, right? The critical step, or the committed step. So turning that gene on or off is one way of controlling whether cholesterol gets produced or not. Okay? The SRE here is not part of, it is part of the DNA. It's just represented by the letters SRE. And that SRE stands for sterol regulating element. It's a little stretch of DNA that is able to be connected to a protein acting as a transcription factor. Transcription factors are proteins that by binding or unbinding to promoter regions of genes determine whether the gene will or will not be transcribed. All right? So SRE is DNA. The blue thing is not DNA. The blue thing is the transcription factor itself that is able to recognize and bind to that sterol regulatory element. All right? Now notice the blue thing is on its own right now, but normally it is associated with the rest of this blue stuff that's embedded in the plasma membrane. So not in the nucleus. This is not in the nucleus at the moment. The curved blue thing that is able to actually enter the nucleus and bind to SRE is called the DNA binding domain of this overall protein that's called SREBP. So SREBP is an acronym that stands for sterol regulatory element binding protein. All right? And so that is a membrane-bound protein, shown in blue. It has a regulatory part of it, labeled as reg, that if it's in contact with this orange protein called SCAP, will not be activated. And therefore, the domain does not get released and it can't go into the nucleus and turn on transcription. Now, SCAP, here's where the ridiculousness comes in. SCAP is not only an acronym, it's a nested acronym. SCAP, of course, is an acronym. You see it all in caps. The S part of SCAP, though, is really just short for SREBP. So SCAP is SREBP cleavage activating protein, which means its full name would be sterol regulatory element binding protein cleavage activating protein. But it's easier just to say SCAP. All right? So, did I say this was the plasma membrane? I didn't mean to. I meant to say the endoplasmic reticular membrane. The endoplasmic reticulum, by the way, remember that that is where lipid synthesis occurs mostly. Do you remember that just in our survey of organelles? Endoplasmic reticulum has other functions as well, but lipid synthesis is one of those. And so mostly in the liver, the endoplasmic reticulum is where this is happening. Anyway, cholesterol is able to either bind or unbind from SCAP. And when it's bound to SCAP, it disallows the release of this blue half moon, which means it can't travel to the nucleus and bind to the DNA and turn on the gene coding for the enzyme that will allow for cholesterol synthesis to occur. Which hopefully makes sense to you, right? Because if it's cholesterol that's available to bind to this thing to prevent it from transcribing, that's an appropriate signal. If you have cholesterol to bind to this thing, that means you don't need to make more cholesterol. On the other hand, if you're short of cholesterol, it's not going to be binding, and therefore this serine protease, green enzyme, is able to interfere when cholesterol is not there, and that's what allows the regulatory portion to disassemble from the SCAP in orange, allowing for this half moon blue thing to go into the nucleus and bind to the regulatory element part of the DNA. Okay? Does that make sense? Are you going to remember that full name? All right, let's go to 17. This table lists various kinds of lipoproteins. Lipoproteins are called that because they are part lipid and part protein. When lipids are produced, like I said, chiefly in the liver, the liver isn't producing those lipids for itself, for the most part. Instead, it's producing those things for the rest of the body, which means those lipids need to be transported to the other parts of the body. And what do you transport things in? To get them everywhere in the body. Blood, exactly. Specifically, the extracellular component of blood, which we call what? Plasma, which is mostly water. What's the problem here? Lipids are hydrophobic, so they don't dissolve in water. They therefore can't easily be carried by watery plasma to the other tissues that need them. So they need to be packaged with some amount of proteins as well to make them soluble. And those soluble little packages are called lipoproteins. Now, lipoproteins are classified into these rows based on their density. And this is arranged low density at the top and it goes up in density. What determines the density of the lipoprotein is the ratio of protein to lipid. Protein is more dense than lipid. And by dense here, I'm not talking about energy density. I'm talking about actual density, mass per volume. Therefore, if you have a high ratio of protein to lipid, conversely, you have more lipid than protein, right? If you have more lipid than protein, then you're going to have a lower density. That's what's happening with chylomicrons. Remember I mentioned that word earlier? Chylomicrons are little lipoproteins that are assembled in the epithelial cells of the small intestine, of the different parts of the small intestine. And the main job of the small intestine is absorption. So digestion has already occurred. Small intestine does some important digestion as well. But by the time you get toward the end of the small intestine, everything is small enough pieces that it can actually be absorbed by the epithelial cells. And if those if the nutrient that you're eating is fat, those free fatty acids and the glycerol that you get when you digest a fat, still outside of the body, still in the lumen, get packaged as they come into the cell into chylomicrons. Those chylomicrons, all the other nutrients, by the way, get sent through the hepatic portal system, a specific shunt of the bloodstream to the liver first, but not the breakdown of fats. Those get put into chylomicrons and then get sent into the lymph instead of the bloodstream. You have a whole series of extra tubes called lymphatic vessels that receive these chylomicrons, but then they dump them into, along with all the other lymph, into the bloodstream. Lymph collects all the stuff that leaks out of the bloodstream and then returns it so that you don't have edema, swelling. You would die without your lymphatic system for that reason alone. But another function of the lymphatic vessels is to receive these chylomicrons and therefore deliver fatty acids to the bloodstream in a soluble form. Then you have very low density. They're very low compared to the ones farther down, but a very low density lipoprotein or VLDL is actually higher density than a chylomicron. Okay? The very low density lipoproteins have a slightly higher proportion of protein in them and therefore are slightly higher density than chylomicrons. When you have even higher protein to lipid ratio, you're into intermediate density, then low density lipoproteins and high density lipoproteins. These bottom two are the ones that are the most famous now because of the obesity epidemic that this country is facing and all the atherosclerosis problems, right? LDL cholesterol and HDL cholesterol get their names from low-density lipoprotein and high-density lipoprotein. It's the same cholesterol in both cases. It's just being carried in two different kinds of lipoproteins. So it's not different versions of cholesterol. When we say good and bad cholesterol, that's really a misnomer. It's just being carried by different densities of lipoproteins. And let's look at how these things operate in slide 18. So you have the liver producing bile acids, like I said, out of cholesterol. That's used as detergent, like I've already discussed. But you also have fat coming in from the diet being packaged into, or fatty acids from fat being packaged into chylomicrons, travel around. The liver also, though, produces cholesterol for distribution to the rest of the body, and it releases that cholesterol in very low density lipoproteins, which as they go through the bloodstream will be stripped of some of the fatty acids that those very low density lipoproteins are carrying by enzymes that are in the capillaries. So the blood is exposed to the capillaries, of course, and some of those enzymes will strip some of the fatty acids from the VLDL. VLDL is carrying fatty acids. Okay, it's basically fatty acids and cholesterol inside, and then phospholipids and protein on the surface of this sphere that allows it to be solubilized. But anyway, when you take some free fatty acids away, if the adipose tissue takes them in, they're going to incorporate that into fat, right? Or just the tissues need the fatty acids for energy, like the muscles. What you leave then is something of intermediate density. So VLDL is turning into IDL as you remove some of these free fatty acids. That continues, and eventually you end up with LDL, low-density lipoproteins, right? And that's the stuff that gets a bad name in the press, right? Because too much LDL can lead to plaque that leads to atherosclerosis, a major cardiovascular disease or circulatory disease. But LDL, notice, gets sent back because the bloodstream is coming back all the time to the liver, and the liver will take up LDL and repackage it with more fatty acids to produce more VLDLs. So it's just a cycle. So LDL, his main function is to carry cholesterol to the other, in terms of cholesterol, fatty acids as well, but cholesterol gets carried to the rest of the cells of the body by LDL. All right? HDL has a different purpose. HDL's main job is to pick up cholesterol from cells that are disintegrating. As cells die and their membranes get dismantled, that releases cholesterol because cholesterol is a major membrane component. HDLs pick these up, these cholesterol molecules, to take them back to the liver for reprocessing. All right? So, health-wise, what you want is a high HDL and a low LDL number, right? But why is it HDL? Why is it high density? Because this has a higher ratio of proteins to lipids, and therefore has a higher density overall. Okay, let's go to 19 now and look at these LDL receptors that are on the surface of hepatocytes or liver cells. These LDL receptors obviously recognize LDL, specifically the protein component of LDL. Remember, any lipoprotein has a protein component on its surface. That protein component serves as a ligand, something that can bind to something else, right? That gets recognized by specific receptors called LDL receptors. And so when an LDL happens along and binds to an LDL receptor, then that triggers endocytosis. So this is specifically an example of what you should have studied and what is called receptor-mediated endocytosis. That's how the LDLs make it back into the liver. But then, like I said, more cholesterol and more lipids are added, and the whole cycle starts again. All right, now let's talk about the other jobs of cholesterol. Well, in 20, what we're seeing is what I've already told you. You're just seeing it in picture form. Cholesterol is transformed into bile salts. Glycocholate or glycocholate is a major bile salt. So we're not looking at any of the details of the pathway here, but that's one major function of cholesterol. So this is a detergent molecule, like I was saying, for the purpose of emulsification of fats so that they can be more easily digested. It doesn't do the digestion, just the emulsification. And then 21, we can see also something I've already told you. Cholesterol, remember there's 27 carbons in cholesterol because you lose three of those in that cyclization process. Anyway, cholesterol is the precursor to all the steroids. And there are major classes of steroids. These pink names are not names of individual substances. They are names of classes of steroids. The progestogens have as their chief representative what? What is the main progestogen? Progesterone, right? Progesterone is a progestogen. Progesterone is named for the fact that it promotes gestation. It's the hormone of pregnancy. Gestation is pregnancy. So it prepares the uterus to be a suitable place for a growing zygote, then embryo, then fetus. Progestogens then can be, if the purpose is not to use them as progestogens, they can then be converted into any of these three other major classes. Glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids are produced where? Does anyone know? Close, but not the actual kidneys. What appears just above the kidneys? Adrenal glands. They are adrenal, or next to the kidneys. Well, the adrenal gland is an example of an organ that has a superficial component, the cortex, and a deeper part, the medulla. The medulla makes totally different stuff compared to the cortex. In the cortex, you have glucocorticoids being produced, which are important for glucose metabolism. And you have mineralocorticoids, which are important for ionic balance, balance of minerals, specifically sodium and potassium. The chief glucocorticoid, there are several, like I said, these are classes, but the chief glucocorticoid is cortisol, a stress hormone, keeps your brain alive by giving it continuous glucose when you're stressed. The chief mineralocorticoid is aldosterone, and it looks like I'm out of time. So I'll finish just one more slide, I think, anyway, but I'll finish next time, which I guess will be a week from now, right?